This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says an explosion near a nuclear site in Natanz was a result of testing air defense systems in a safe zone. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian man in occupied East Al-Quds. And thousands of people take to the streets of the Netherlands and Austria to protest their government's measures to contain a record coronavirus surge. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's air defense forces say that they've carried out a test in the central province of Isfahan. Drill was carried out nearly 20 kilometers away from the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran's army spokesperson says test was conducted in full coordination with the country's integrated air defense network.
About an hour ago, one of the missile systems in the region was tested to ensure its field readiness. The test was carried out to assess the performance of the system installed in the region. Such drills take place in a safe environment with full coordination with the integrated defense network. There's no reason for concern.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has called for expansion of ties between Tehran and Caracas. In a phone conversation with President Maduro, Raisi said the two countries should increase economic relations and trade volume. He also called for greater oil cooperation between the two nations. The president believes the two countries need to take greater steps in refining and petrochemical fields. He also slammed Washington's sanctions against Caracas. Maduro hailed Iran's support for the Venezuelan people and hoped Tehran and Caracas will sign a new cooperation agreement. Ebrahim Raisi became the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran in early August. During his time in office, he has sought to strengthen ties with neighbors and other countries, particularly those on the eastern side of the globe. Domestically, he's focused on strengthening the country's vaccination campaign against the coronavirus pandemic. Here's a report.
August the 5th, 2021, Ebrahim Raisi becomes Iran's eighth president after a landslide victory in elections. He had little time to celebrate his win. Iran was facing a plethora of challenges, from both within and without. Raisi had to steer the country under severe U.S. sanctions and hit by a raging global pandemic. The first order of business was making sure of people's health. When Raisi took the helm, Iran was recording over 30,000 daily COVID cases. Several hundred people were also losing their lives to the virus each day. In less than 5 months, the numbers began to fall significantly. Iran got to have just over 2,000 new coronavirus cases every day. The number of fatalities reported daily has fallen below 60, and 3 out of 5 Iranians have been fully vaccinated. Also high on Raisi's foreign policy agenda has been expanding ties with neighboring countries. To that end, in late August, Iran attended a summit in the Iraqi capital. There, Iran's foreign minister met with its counterpart from Persian Gulf states in a bid to strengthen bilateral ties. Raisi's foreign policy brought Iran a major milestone in September, when the country became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a multinational body which includes the likes of China, Russia, and India, and enjoys wide-scale global influence. President Raisi has also tried to shore up the country's economy by relieving the pressure of sanctions. His government has taken part in the Vienna negotiations in a bid to have US-imposed sanctions on Iran removed. The next round of talks is set to kick off next week. The challenges Iran is facing are by no means over, but judging President Raisi's first 4 months in office, better days seem to be in the offing for the country.
Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian in the occupied Al-Quds area. Footage from the scene shows Israeli forces shooting at the Palestinian at least twice after he was already lying on the ground. The incident took place near the Damascus Gate, just outside the Old City. The Palestinian was identified as a 25-year-old from the occupied West Bank. Israeli police said that he tried to stab an officer after wounding a first man. Another video appears to show police with guns drawn preventing medics from reaching the man. Clashes later broke out at the scene between Palestinians and Israeli forces who used stun grenades. Israel has repeatedly been criticized for extensive use of lethal force against Palestinians and their extrajudicial killings. Joining us now from Ramallah is Mona Candil for an update on the story. Hello, Mona. Hope you're safe and doing well. What can you tell us?
Well, according to the footage, it seems filmed by a bystander and widely shared on social media, showing the a man in jeans lying on a sidewalk and Israeli police officers firing shoots at him at point-blank range. As you have mentioned, it's a lethal killing. It's a deliberate shooting of a wounded man lying on the ground. He didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers, but at least the soldiers fired twice at him from the point-blank range. It was a deliberate killing. The identity of this Palestinian man, he's 25 years old, Mohammed Shawkat Salami, from the town of Salfit, northern the occupied West Bank. And the Israeli statement, the Israeli police statement, said that he attempted to stab Israeli soldiers there near Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Of course, it's one of the gates in the old town of Al-Quds. He tried to stab the Israeli soldiers. That's why the forces opened fire at him. And they wounded him, and he was lying on the ground, but they didn't arrest him. They chose to execute him, to immediately kill him. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that he fully backed the Israeli officers, and he supported them to kill anyone posing any kind of threat against the Israeli forces anywhere in the occupied territories. The Palestinian, the different political powers condemned this killing as a killing and murdering of a Palestinian man. Hamas movement issued a statement saying it's a deliberate killing of a wounded man who didn't pose any threat to anyone.
And Mona, if you remember, we saw just a couple of years ago, we saw that so-called IDF soldier kill another unarmed man that was completely of no threat on the ground, and he ended up and getting only about, what, a year in prison. He was back with his family after literally murdering the guy on TV in broad daylight. You remember that? What was the name? Something Azaria, I believe the soldier was?
That's right. This incident happened in the occupied West Bank of Al-Khalil, and he was, this Palestinian man was killed in cold blood. The Israeli soldier was arrested by the Israeli forces, of course, and he was tried in the Israeli court. However, he received only a 1 year behind the bars. This is nothing for killing a human being without posing any threat. But when it comes to a Palestinian being killed by the Israeli forces, there are orders from the Israeli military establishment and from their rabbis. Even they encourage them to kill Palestinians in cold blood, knowing that they would not be, of course, tried in the Israeli courts. It would be only to deceive the world that the killer was arrested and he was tried. But it's nothing 1 year behind bars for killing a Palestinian or killing a human being without posing any threat. That's why the Israeli soldiers are quick to pull the trigger, because they know they would not be punished for killing any Palestinian in the occupied territories.
All right, Mona, thank you. Stay safe. Thanks for that update. From Ramallah, Mona Candil joining us. Local media reports say a fresh air raid by a Saudi-led coalition on Yemen's capital city of Sana'a. A number of people have been injured in the airstrike. Attack targeted a food depot in Sana'a and caused damage to nearby homes. There are also reports of similar airstrikes on other Yemeni cities, including Sada'a and Hajja, as well as Taiz, which was also bombed Friday. The number of victims in Friday's attack has now increased to 18. These attacks are the latest in ongoing Saudi onslaught, which have killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis over the past 6 years. The dispute over general elections in Iraq is dragging on. Head of Iraq's Fatah Alliance, Hadi Amiri, has once again rejected the results. Amiri accuses the country's election commission of mismanagement and violations. He says the commission did not present any report on vote irregularities to parliament. Amiri promised not to back down from the lawsuit on election fraud and continue the process in the federal court. He also accused the UN envoy to Iraq of interfering in the election process. Now on Tuesday, the Electoral Commission reconfirmed the political bloc led by Muqtada al-Sadr as winner of October's parliamentary elections following weeks of recounting. Federal court now needs to approve the final results. The Fatah Alliance and several political groups oppose the vote outcome. Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets of Austria and the Netherlands in protest at restrictions to combat a resurgence of the coronavirus pandemic. More than 40,000 people marched through the Austrian capital, Vienna, as hundreds of police officers stood by. The government last month made Austria the first country in Western Europe to reimpose a lockdown in the face of surging daily infections. It's also planning to make vaccinations compulsory from February. A similar but smaller march was held in the central Dutch city of Utrecht amid a heavy presence of security forces. Violent protests broke out 3 weeks ago, shortly after the Dutch government made lockdown announcement. Tighter restrictions have since come into effect. Daily infections in the Netherlands reached a record high of nearly 24,000 late last month. The country's also become a hotspot for the new variant, Omicron. Number of COVID cases has increased in several countries amid the spread of the Omicron variant. Russia has announced nearly 33,000 daily infections, along with 1,200 new deaths. It's imposed restrictions on travelers coming from South Africa, where the Omicron variant was first detected. Germany has announced a spike in its cases with over 64,000 daily infections. Australia says the number of people who tested positive for Omicron has grown to 13. India has also reported its third case of the new variant. Omicron was first detected on November 24th. It's spread now to nearly 40 countries. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests that Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade some immunity to COVID-19. Anger boiling in Serbia over the government's new mining plans. Thousands of environmentalists blocked major roads and bridges throughout the country for a second Saturday in a row now in protests at the projects. Thousands gathered on the main bridge in the capital Belgrade and stopped traffic on the main highway, that despite police warnings and an intimidation campaign by authorities. A number of other cities were sconces of similar protests. Scenes, that is, of similar protests. Environmentalists are angry at the government's plan to give mining rights to two foreign companies. They're also against two newly passed laws, which they say will lay the groundwork for a lithium mining operation. They're worried that laws will let foreign companies exploit local resources. Green activists say projects will pollute the land and water in the Balkan nation. Moscow dismisses new U.S. media reports about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine. It instead accuses Washington of provocative actions near Russian borders. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman has been cited by a newspaper as saying U.S. is conducting a special operation to aggravate the situation around Ukraine. Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of adopting accusatory rhetoric to shift the responsibility for the escalation onto Russia. The remarks were made after a Saturday report by the Washington Post accusing Russia of planning a multi-front offensive on Ukraine early next year. This is the second time in the past month U.S. media has made such a claim. Moscow says allegations could be aimed at diverting attention from Kiev's own plans to escalate tensions in eastern Ukraine. Political commentator Tim Kirby believes that U.S. media reports about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine are part of Washington's broader campaign to create further rift between Moscow and Kiev.
We can't forget that since the Maidan Revolution of 2014, the mainstream media has reported that Russia has already invaded the Ukraine multiple times. Now they're writing that there is a threat of invasion. All right, so first off, this is already sort of in a 1984 nutty world. About the Russian reaction, Russians are very concerned right now that this is going to be what you could call the big one. When the mainstream media turns their eye to something, they always escalate or inflate, and it's never purely coincidental. I'll put it that way. There's a lot of events going on all over the world. Some are shown, some are not, and this one is definitely getting the hype as of today. I think that there is some sort of attempt to create a final rift between the Ukraine and Russia to sort of end this issue in a way that's going to be favorable to Washington. Because as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, Russia will never be, this is a paraphrase, Russia will never be a great empire or superpower again without the Ukraine. So perhaps that's what they're trying to do.
Meanwhile, Russia condemns Western countries for imposing fresh sanctions against Belarus over accusations that Minsk is stoking a migrant crisis. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has criticized the sanctions as illegitimate and interference in Belarusian internal affairs. She believes restrictions are inhumane because they negatively impact the lives of Belarusian citizens. On Thursday, the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and the European Union imposed new sanctions on Belarus. They accused Minsk of fomenting the migrant crisis for political gains against the European Union, a claim denied by Belarus. In recent months, thousands of migrants from West Asia have traveled to Belarus in hopes of entering the European Union through Poland. Poland and Lithuania are pushing them back, leaving them behind barbed wires and freezing temperatures. One person has died and dozens have suffered burns following a volcanic eruption on the Indonesian island of Java. Mount Semeru has been sending large plumes of smoke and ash into the sky since Saturday afternoon. Smoke plumes reportedly reached a height of over 12 kilometers, forcing thousands of nearby residents to flee. Airlines have been warned that the ash could rise up to 15 kilometers. Officials say a number of areas went dark after being covered by volcanic ash. The lava flow has also destroyed a road and a bridge. Evacuations are underway as we speak. Southeast Asian nation is home to nearly 130 active volcanoes. In late 2018, an eruption in the strait between Java and Sumatra Islands caused a tsunami which killed more than 400 people.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Data collected by Tianwen-1 mission and Zhurong Mars rover are offering insights into a previously unexplored region of Mars' northern hemisphere. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati, writer. This article is published under the heading, China's Mars rover has amassed reams of novel geological data. Stay tuned for more. More than 30 scientists across mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau are rushing to process data collected by China's Mars rover, Zhurong, and by the nation's Tianwen-1 spacecraft, which is in orbit around the planet. Several studies have trickled out, but researchers say that more are coming in the next weeks and months, offering insights on the climate, geology, and history of Mars' northern hemisphere. Since September, the National Astronomical Observatories of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, NAOC, which has been receiving the data from space, has released nearly 200 gigabytes of information that was collected from 8 instruments on the rover, an orbiter, between February and June. These instruments include cameras, a radar system, climate sensors, and a laser spectrometer. Some surface features, such as possible sedimentary material and potential mud volcanoes, hint at the historic flow of water, so scientists are looking for any clues that there was once water or ice below the surface. This is of great scientific interest, as it might provide evidence of an ancient ocean, says Bo Wu, a planetary scientist at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, who is analyzing some of the data. Tianwen-1 arrived at Mars in February. In May, it dropped a lander containing Zhurong onto a vast basin known as Utopia Plancha. The rover's initial mission was intended to be only about 3 months long, but it has exceeded expectations. Over a period of 4 months, the rover traveled more than 1,000 meters, visiting features of interest and even investigating part of the capsule that brought it to the surface, along with the remains of the descent parachute. In September, Zhurong was powered down into hibernation by the China National Space Administration, CNSA, because Mars had passed behind the Sun relative to Earth, meaning that communication was lost. However, in October, it was powered up again and has traversed another 200 meters in the direction of what may once have been the coastline of an ancient ocean. The month-long break offered mission scientists at research institutes across China a chance to start analyzing data. Some researchers had already received images of Mars from orbiters' cameras in March, and the CNSA had previously shared with the public images and videos taken by the rover during its descent and from the surface. But now researchers are studying the much larger volume of data released in September. This data set includes images from Zhurong's navigation camera, climatic data on temperature, pressure, and wind speed, information on the chemical composition of rocks, soil, sand dunes from a laser spectrometer, and clues from below the surface from its ground-penetrating radar. Apart from the handful of images and videos released by the CNSA, few scientific insights about the mission have been released or published until now. Researchers say this is because it has taken time to process and clean up the data. Doing this ensures that the data are reliable and removes noise produced by the instrument, says Lu Pan, a planetary scientist at the University of Copenhagen. The fact that this mission is China's first to the surface of another planet might also have slowed things down compared with NASA's recent Mars missions. She says, if this is the first time you do it, there is a learning process. David Flannery, an astrobiologist at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, who is in communication with scientists in China, says that the team's approach to managing data could also have contributed to the delay in releasing new insights. With NASA's Perseverance mission, which Flannery is involved in, each instrument on the rover is designed by a different team, which has exclusive access to data from that instrument for a few months before it becomes available to all. But under the CNSA model, the data generated for all the instruments on the Zhurong and Tianwen-1 are processed by the NAOC before making the information available to multiple teams of scientists linked to the mission. Two publications have already emerged. One study posted as a preprint in late September analyzed images and information friction that were gleaned from the movement of Zhurong's wheels. The results show that regions of Mars that the rover trundled over have properties similar to those of compact sandy soil on Earth. The study provides useful data about surface soil properties, says Xiao Long, a planetary geologist at the China University of Geosciences in Wuhan. This might be helpful for understanding how soil and dust on the surface formed, says Long, who is also conducting his own analysis. A second study published in August used high-resolution images from the orbiter to pinpoint the rover's precise coordinates on Mars, but researchers say that many more studies are expected soon, including some on the region's topography. So far, the data has been shared only with researchers directly involved with the mission, but Wu says the NAOC will at some point release them to the public and the international community. That could help to speed up the analysis. Scientists with more experience of Mars might be able to recognize features of interest and their significance more quickly, says Flannery. Mars is peculiar in some ways, and geologists are only as good as the rocks they have seen in the past, he adds. Zhurong will now continue to explore potentially for years, as some of NASA's Mars rovers have. Tianwen-1 has also been busy. The spacecraft recently adjusted its orbit and switched from acting mainly as a communications relay between Zhurong and Earth to also conducting its own observations of Mars. Wen's five planetary scientists at Peking University Beijing, who is analyzing Zhurong's radar data, says that on November 11th, the CNSA deployed and began to test antenna for the orbiter's radar. Also earlier this month, the CNSA and the European Space Agency trialed whether the ESA Mars Express orbiter could be used to relay Zhurong's data to Earth, an exercise that Pan says is an amazing step towards increased international collaboration with China. As Zhurong resumes his journey, Bo says that he and his team are providing suggestions for future data collection that take in surface features of particular scientific interest.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, recently in the news, we have read that the Palestinian families are facing the threat of forced eviction from their homes in East Al-Quds, neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, you know, and they have rejected an Israeli court so-called conflict resolution proposal that would be enable Israeli settlers to eventually confiscate their land in 15 years. And this is the news, a really nice achievement for the families of Sheikh Jarrah, who rejected the compromise offered to them by the court of the occupation and the Israelis. So with the Sayyid Murtaza, first of all, give us the story. What's the story exactly? What's the story of the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah?
Well, actually, no, it's part of the Palestinian history. Mm-hmm. And many parts of the East Jerusalem, unfortunately, have been taken by these occupiers.
Yes.
Specifically talking these Jews who are following the political philosophy of Zionism.
Yes.
And this was actually the main reason.
Yes.
That now we have Palestinian resistance.
Yes.
To any forced displacement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, over the past 40, 60 years, thousands, or I better to say millions of Palestinians have been displaced, not only internally but externally.
That's right. We have
IDPs, I mean internal displaced people, inside the occupied land, the Palestine. And we have many Palestinians have been expelled, and they have been forced to leave the Palestine forever.
Yes.
So this shows that the history has been unfortunately very tough and difficult on Palestinians.
Yes.
And actually this forced displacement is something that they are inheriting from past.
Okay.
I mean, it was not their own choice. It was not made arbitrarily. It was something that was brought upon them by outsiders.
Yes.
So now this neighborhood and other areas that are facing some kind of forced eviction or displacement is the same thing that happened around 40, 60 years ago.
Yes.
So the history is full of this kind of evictions.
That's right.
And now, because we have medias, and because these people who are facing such a forced displacement have the opportunity to use the medias, and they actually raise their voice.
That's
to
right.
The whole world, that what is happening in that area is not fair and is not even good according to the international standards. And we know international standards are not fair.
That's right.
So equality has been gone.
That's right.
So this neighborhood has a very rich history.
Mm-hmm. You mean look Sheikh Jarrah?
Yeah, look at the name this neighborhood.
Yes, yes.
Sheikh Jarrah, he was a very influential figure in that area.
Yes.
And even this neighborhood comes after him.
Yes.
So if this settling commissioner, I can say, comes to believe that they are able to evacuate this neighborhood from the influential factors, other settlers in the same neighborhood will actually leave,
mm-hmm.
and they will be, evacuated by any means.
That's right.
So, unfortunately, we have four or five, neighbors now that they are just involved in fighting back such a unfair decision that was made by a Zionist, I think, court.
That's right.
So, the background, the historical background of this neighborhood or this place is very much known to the local Palestinians, and now it has been internationally known to the whole world.
That's all right, and we know that, this Sheikh Jarrah protest, coincided with the decision to ban gathering in the Muslim in the holy month of Ramadan. As could you remember, they have attacked the Damascus gate of the holy city of Al-Quds, and the riots are over there. 260 Palestinians were killed, 66 children among them.
Yeah.
And this was the most sad news. Again, we could see this international silence in the media on this side. But still, the four Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah have requested, the world in order to see what's happening over there, because the east of Al-Quds is being evacuated wholly from the families over there. So, Sayyid Mohsen, what's your take on that, brother, and this story?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there is a clear statement in the Quran in chapter Nisa, verse number 148. Mm-hmm. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لا يحب الله الجهر بسوء من القول إلا من ظلم. Allah does not like someone to declare or openly talk about the evil if someone has done evil to someone or a wrong thing to someone, except if it was an oppression or ظلم. So if there is some injustice, if there is an oppression, then obviously you must, you know, speak out, you must protest, and you must talk about it, inform others. This is the rule set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran. وَكَانَ اللَّهُ سَمِيعًا عَلِيمًا. So, and Allah is the all-hearing and all-knowing. What these four families are doing, it's really courageable, and we must congratulate them on their courage that they have. And obviously we know that they're living there for many years, and it's from their forefathers, from when they're living. And just because being at the neighbor, like the settlers that at the neighbor of that area, like which is for the Zionist regime, if they want to evacuate it,
They want to turn it into a public park. Yeah. This is the news.
Okay. So basically it's against the human rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have some human beings living there, which are there for many years, and even their forefathers were there, and now you're coming and you want to evacuate them.
Yes.
For your own, we can say,
especially political
for ease or the political pleasure. Yes. Or entertainment, what you have. So what these families are doing, it's really, it's a good thing, it's a good step which they have taken. And if they evacuate that place, then obviously the rest of the people will also evacuate. Obviously, it will be very easy for the Zionist regime to evacuate anyone. But if they have resistance, if the Zionist regime face resistance from these four families, then obviously it will be something hard for them to evacuate the rest of places. And obviously it's our duty, everyone's duty, to show our sympathy with these four families.
That's right.
Which are also in, so according to some writings I was reading, that they belong, they are the families of Sheikh Jarrah.
Yes.
They are the relatives of Sheikh Jarrah. And Sheikh Jarrah was someone who has a value or a noble person.
Yes.
In his area.
He
was an active person, yes, in his area. So why the pressure is only on these four families and not the rest? This is another question. And the same thing which you mentioned, like in the month of Ramadan, the way they had the massive killing of these Muslims, that was unfortunately something.
66 children have been killed in those attacks, 11-day attacks on the coastal region of, you know, the Palestine at that time.
And I don't know why the human rights is silent now. Where does the UNO goes?
Yeah.
Where this UNICEF, what this UNICEF is doing
because
right
Israel
now.
Is not a legitimate land. What has to do with the UN, you know, because it's not a part of the UN even.
These countries can basically decide something about this oppression or these regime that are basically occupying, and they're obviously expanding or doing oppression over these people.
Yes.
So at least they should speak out. They should take a stand against what they're doing. And I think this is the time when the world needs to show themselves that on the basis of human rights, at least, they should save these four families. They should save these places. And let's not allow Israeli do whatever they want.
Yes.
And this is the time that the whole Muslim Ummah should, stand against it and spread this news amongst the people, so people get awareness.
Yes.
And the way we can see, like I was just looking at the yesterday's news, that there was a football match behind which people were flying the flags of Palestine.
Yeah, in Spain. Yes.
So alhamdulillah, we can see that there are some people who are basically spreading the word, and people are getting So we need such kind of movement to stop this Zionist regime from whatever they want to, like stopping them from doing what they want to do.
You know, Mona Al-Kord, you know, one of the Sheikh Jarrah's resistants, has said that the Israeli judiciary is circumventing its obligation to issue a final decision and is making us choose between dispossession of our lands and submitting to an unjust agreement, we won't allow Israel to make itself as a just occupation at our expense. This is what Amon Al-Court has said, you know, to the media. And that's it, choosing between disposition, I mean, leaving your land, and also submitting to an unjust agreement. They have put this family between the two. Okay, Samuels, any remarks?
Well, you know, a freedom fighter, I can call it Mujahid,
yes,
will never actually surrender his own freedom to tyranny,
yes,
to unjust government, or any ruling power.
Yes.
So what these four families have been doing for a while is very much expected from a freedom fighter.
Yes.
So, and you know, most of these Palestinians living under, you know, tough, very harsh condition are fighting back the Zionist regime, as many military officials said, is enjoying one of the greatest, you know, military equipments,
yes,
and military means.
Yes.
So this shows that maybe you are able to fight back, you know, bare hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these four families have actually presented this ideology that surrendering to an unjust government is not what can actually solve your problem.
That's
it's
right.
going to make your problem bigger, yes, and larger and more difficult to manage.
Yes.
So these four families so far have proved that they are believing in a very strong ideology that freedom will come upon you if you just wait and keep fighting back.
That's all right. That's all right. This is good news, and may Allah help them, inshallah, to have their own lands and possess it again and not evacuate that region, because I think this is a piece of a big puzzle, you know, of the Zionist power in that region, East Al-Quds, to occupy the whole land over there, the public park, you know, man. All we know that this is a political game, you know, and just the surface of the matter.
You know, even the statement that the judicials have, the statement that either you leave immediately or you can settle for, you know, 15 years.
Yes.
This shows us that it is their own place.
Mm-hmm.
They were living there. They own that place.
Yes.
And the Zionist regime has no right to throw them out of that place.
Yes.
Why they're giving them, you know, if they have occupied that land and it's related to the Zionist regime, then obviously they shouldn't allow them to live for even a single day. Why they're giving them these 15
yes.
years to settle for 15 years and then you need to leave?
I believe no part of the Palestine
yeah.
belongs to Israel.
Obviously, we know that.
Okay.
This is clear.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, within the statements, the things are clear.
Yes.
These statements shows us. So therefore, the world should stand against what the Zionist regime are doing
yes.
and give the right to these four families what
mm-hmm.
they have. And similarly, it will give courage to the rest of the settlers
yes.
who are around this area, inshallah. And the victory is with the Palestinian nations,
yes.
not anyone else.
So there's so many lessons also in the behavior of these four families in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood for some of the so-called Muslim lands that have been the base for the Western powers, you know, inside the countries. You know, we have to learn many lessons from the behaviors of this family over there in Sheikh Jarrah. And I hope that one day it will be free and Palestine will be free, inshallah. Thank you very much, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen.
You're welcome.
For your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and also to download for free our previous episodes of this program, refer to our website, parstoday.com/ENT. Another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Sources tell The Guardian former U.S. President Donald Trump pressed lieutenants at Willard Hotel in Washington about ways to delay certification of election results on January 6. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Hugo Lowell under the heading Trump called aides hour before Capitol riot to discuss how to stop Biden's victory. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Before the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol this year, former U.S. President Donald Trump made several calls from the White House to top lieutenants at Willard Hotel in Washington and talked about ways to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election win from taking place on January 6th. The former president first told the lieutenants his vice president, Mike Pence, was reluctant to go along with the plan to commandeer his largely ceremonial role at the joint session of Congress in a way that would allow Trump to retain the presidency for a second term. But as Trump relayed to them the situation with Pence, he pressed his lieutenants about how to stop Biden's certification from taking place on January 6th and delay the certification process to get alternate slates of electors for Trump sent to Congress. The former president's remarks came as part of a strategy discussions he had from the White House with lieutenants at the Willard, a team led by Trump lawyers Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Boris Epstein, and Trump strategist Steve Bannon about delaying the certification. Multiple sources speaking to The Guardian on the condition of anonymity described Trump's involvement in the effort to subvert the results of the 2020 election. Trump's remarks reveal a direct line from the White House and the command center at the Willard. The conversations also show Trump's thoughts appear to be in line with the motivations of the pro-Trump mob that carried out the Capitol attack and halted Biden's certification until it was later ratified by Congress. The former president's call to the Willard Hotel about stopping Biden's certification is increasingly a central focus of the House Select Committee's investigation into the Capitol attack as it raises the specter of a possible connection between Trump and the insurrection. Several Trump lawyers at the Willard that night denied Trump sought to stop the certification of Biden's election win. They claim they only considered delaying Biden's certification at the request of state legislators because of voter fraud. The former president made several calls to the lieutenants at the Willard the night before January 6. He phoned the lawyers and the non-lawyers separately, as Giuliani did not want non-lawyers to participate on legal calls and jeopardize attorney-client privilege. Trump's call to the lieutenants came a day after Eastman, a late addition to the Trump legal team, outlined at January 4th meeting at the White House how he thought Pence could usurp his role in order to stop Biden's certification from happening at the joint session. At the meeting, which was held in the Oval Office and attended by Trump, Pence, Chief of Staff Mars Short and his legal counsel Greg Jacob Eastman presented a memo that detailed how Pence could insert himself into the certification and delay the process. The memo outlined several ways for Pence to commander his role at the joint session, including throwing the election to the House, or adjourning the session to give states time to send slates of electors for Trump on the basis of election fraud, Eastman's preference. The then-acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen and his predecessor Bill Barr, who had both been appointed by Trump, had already determined there was no evidence of fraud sufficient to change the outcome of the 2020 election. Eastman told The Guardian last month that the memo only presented scenarios and was not intended as advice. Eastman said, "The advice I gave the vice president very explicitly was that I did not think he had the authority simply to declare which electors to count." Trump seized on the memo, first reported by Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa in their book Peril, and pushed Pence to adopt the schemes which some of other lieutenants at Willard later told Trump were legitimate ways to flip the election. But Pence resisted Trump's entreaties and told him in the Oval Office the next day that Trump should count him out of whatever plans he had to subvert the results of the 2020 election at the joint session because he did not intend to take part. Trump was furious at Pence for refusing to do him a final favor when, in the critical moment underpinning the effort to reinstall Trump as president, he phoned lieutenants at the Willard sometime between the late evening of January 5th and the early hours of January 6th. From the White House, Trump made several calls to lieutenants, including Giuliani, Eastman, Epstein, and Bannon, who were huddled in suits complete with espresso machines and Cokes in a mini fridge in the northwest corner of the hotel. On the calls, the former president first recounted what had transpired in the Oval Office meeting with Pence, informing Bannon and the lawyers at the Willard that his vice president appeared ready to abandon him at a joint session in several hours' time. For instance, in an exchange reported in Peril and confirmed by The Guardian, Trump told Bannon of Pence he is arrogant, his own way of communicating that Pence was unlikely to pay ball. But on at least one of those calls, Trump also sought from the lawyers at the Willard ways to stop the joint session to ensure Biden would not be certified as president on January 6th. As part of a wider discussion about buying time to get states to send Trump electors. The fallback that Trump and his lieutenants appeared to settle on was to cajole Republican members of Congress to raise enough objections so that even without Pence adjourning the joint session, the certification process would be delayed for states to send Trump slates. It was not clear whether Trump discussed on the call about the prospect of stopping Biden's certification by any means if Pence refused to insert himself into the process. But the former president is said to have enjoyed watching the insurrection unfold from the dining room. But the fact that Trump considered ways to stop the joint session may help to explain why he was so reluctant to call off the rioters and why the Republican Senator Ben Sasse told the conservative talk show host Hugh Hewitt that he heard Trump seemed delighted about the attack. Giuliani, the head Trump lawyer at the Willard, appearing to follow that fallback plan, called at least one Republican senator later that same evening, asking him to help keep Congress adjourned and stall the joint session January 6. In a voicemail recorded at about 7 p.m. local time on January 6th and reported by the Dispatch, Giuliani implored the Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville to object to 10 states Biden won once Congress reconvened at 8 p.m. local time, a process that would have concluded 15 hours later, close to January 7th. Giuliani said, "The only strategy we can follow is to object to numerous states and raise issues so that we get ourselves into tomorrow, ideally until the end of tomorrow." Liz Harrington, a spokesperson for Trump, disputed the account of Trump's call for publication. Without giving specifics, Harrington said, "This is totally false. Giuliani did not respond to a request for comment. Eastman, Epstein, and Bannon declined to comment." Trump made several calls the day before the Capitol attack from the both White House residents, his preferred place to work, as well as the West Wing. But it will not certain from which location he phoned his top lieutenants at the Willard. The White House residence and its yellow oval room, a Trump favorite, is significant since communications there, including from a desk phone, are not automatically memorized in records sent to National Archives after the end of an administration. But even if Trump called his lieutenants from the West Wing, the Select Committee may not be able to fully uncover the extent of his involvement in events of January 6th unless House investigators secure testimony from individuals with knowledge of the calls. That difficulty arises since calls from the White House are not necessarily recorded, and call detailed records that the Select Committee is suing to pry free from the National Archives over Trump's objections above and about executive privilege only show the destination of the calls. House Select Committee investigators recently opened a new line of inquiry into activities at the Willard Hotel, just across the street from the White House, issuing subpoenas to Eastman and former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, an assistant to Giuliani. The chairman of the Select Committee, Benny Thompson, said in a statement that the panel was pursuing the Trump officials at the Willard to uncover every detail about their efforts to overturn the election, including who they were talking to in the White House and in Congress.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.